I'm going to start this morning by the normal formula, which is to say that my name is Mike Grayson. I'm at Peterborough, Ontario, Canada, and it is the 27th of October, Monday, 2014, and I'm interviewing Professor Raymond E. March, a mass spectroscopist of note, about his career. So with that kind of informative statement about who we are, what we're about, and that kind of thing, I think we can go ahead and get started. You did get my kind of general list of things we're going to talk about in a general way, and noted that I also, if we can remember to think about who, what, where, when, how, and why, and provide those details as we go along, because that's part of the record that makes it useful, particularly any dates that are significant and individuals that are significant. So what I like to do is really get a little bit of a background of your family. From what I understand, you grew up in the UK.
Yes.
So you were, this was in the late 30s?
I was born in Newcastle upon Tyne, northeast of England, in 1934, on the 13th of March.
Yes. What was the date? I'm sorry.
1934, March the 13th.
Okay, very good.
And Newcastle United. Newcastle is famous for its soccer team, mm-hmm. Newcastle United, which I see won yesterday. And also there's a new musical on Broadway, I think written, directed by Spine or Spink? Spine? I've forgotten his name now. Uh-huh. Shrimp or something like that. And it's about human problems in Wall's End in uh-huh. Newcastle upon Tyne, and that's where I first began working, at Wall's End on Tyne.
So your parents, tell me about your parents, their names, and what their occupations were.
My mother was called Violet. Her maiden name was Waterhouse. She was of limited education. She was born in 1909 and was therefore of limited education, and worked in a number of shops during my lifetime. My father was called Alfred Ernest March, and he was an electrician, an industrial electrician, and worked principally because of the war on ships in Tyneside.
So the Newcastle was close to the coast?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Very good. And now, so you say neither of them really had very much in the way of higher education?
No.
I see. Now, did you have brothers and sisters?
I had one brother, Sidney Ernest, and he died when he was 52. Okay. He also was an electrician.
Uh-huh. Ernest is spelled E-R-N-E-S-T.
That's correct.
Okay. So was there a kind of a emphasis on education in the household that you noticed particularly?
Yes, encouraged, but I started school in September 1939, and that date is better known as the beginning of the Second World War. Mm-hmm. And so things became quite chaotic mm-hmm. for the next 6 years. Mm-hmm. I had an mm-hmm. uncle, the brother of my father, who was in the Air Force and stationed essentially at home, because he was involved with a radio monitoring station in the north of England. So with his help, I learned the Morse code, and he built a little tapper and with a light signal also, and we would practice this on visits when he and my aunt came to visit us. And at that time I was about 7 when we started, and I was absorbing stuff like this wonderful paper that you get from divers. Anything I heard, I could just take in. And so I became quite adept at semaphore. Oh. And we would talk back and forth, and it was enormous fun.
You must have had some pretty interesting experiences during being in the UK during that time period. Do you recall much of the war activity there and how things went?
Yes. I would read the news. The newspapers, of course, would tell you a lot. They would have little photographs of each casualty in the services from that area. The 9 o'clock news, the BBC news at 9 o'clock, was listened to by almost the entire country every night to get some idea of what was going on. It was very sad for a long time. It, of course, was dark at night. That part of the world, it gets dark early in the winter. Mm-hmm. And so it could be dark from 3:30 in the afternoon to after 8 o'clock the next morning. Mm-hmm. And no street lights. Of course, the windows were all covered in sticky paper so that flying glass wouldn't cause injuries. And so you had to be very careful moving around. And my mother had sight only in one eye through an accident just after she was born. And so I would have to walk with her, to take her arm and say, we're coming to the curb, down, the curb, up, and so on, just to guide her. So I was her eyes, although we seldom went out at night. I remember going out to visit a friend in the next street, a friend from school, and then returning, and then there was an air raid that night, and it happened that there was a landmine where it was dropped. Not, there were bombs which came down freely and landmines which floated down with parachutes. And this was a landmine, and it hit his house and some neighbors, and of course they were all killed, and I never saw them again. And for the rest of the war, the places where those houses had been stood empty as a constant reminder of that. Shrapnel was one of the delights, shrapnel collecting. And if you get a fin from an incendiary bomb, that was a real prize. The tailpiece from that, and we would trade shrapnel back and forth. And there was always the odd wag who had found a finger that had been blown off. Mm-hmm. And would show this in a matchbox, wrapped in cotton wool with a bloody... It was actually his own finger, of course, stuck through the bottom, but it all sorts of things happened in those days. And then in 1945, the war ended in Europe, and I had been involved in helping to organize a street party for that in May 1945, and the day before I had appendicitis, and then off to hospital for appendicitis, so I missed the whole thing. In August was the end of the war in Japan, and then the peace started. The peace was little better than the war because food and the conditions were very, very poor. Let me jump and say I've just finished writing with John Todd a retrospective lecture on the development of mass spectrometry in the last 60 years. Mm-hmm. And we've opened our paper talking about the Queen in 1952 being crowned and approved by the Privy Councils of various countries in the Commonwealth as Queen, and that she was 25 at that time. And at Leeds University there is a plaque commemorating the award of the Nobel Prize and to and I'm going to forget the names the names to Bragg, father and son. And the son was 25 when he and his father were awarded the Nobel Prize, and he's still the youngest, noblest, award in physics, certainly, in physics. He's not the youngest noblest. That was 1952. And in 1952, I remember going to a place called Rutherford College in Newcastle in the evening. So it was dark. It was Novemberish. And the lights came on. And sweets, candies were no longer ration. And I came to this shop, and its windows were full of candies and sweets. I had never seen that in my life. I guess when I was less than five, I wasn't out at night, so I never saw one lit up, ever. At that time, 1952, I was 18. And I remember being astonished at that sight. So
the war was, you'd gotten used to such a deprived environment to see something as simple as a window shop full of candy.
Full of candies.
It was an astonishing thing.
It really was. Yeah. I've never forgotten it. And that's why I came out in this, the introduction to this retrospective lecture.
So basically, you had a fairly, going to school during that period must have been a little bit of a challenge. Grade school when you were with the war going on.
Yes, it was. Of course, we didn't fully appreciate when you're just a young lad of six or seven the value of education, and one always had the back of the mind that if there was an air raid after 10 o'clock, then you didn't need to go to school until 10 o'clock in the morning. There was an hour, as you see. Leeway so that you could sleep a little longer. And so that was, in some strange way, actually, a little treat for us, yes. But there were a range of shelters, bomb shelters, that I recall. The worst type, which I was never had to use, was when they would come to your garden and dig in and then put in corrugated steel to make a little safety device. Shelter and then covered that with soil and grass, but of course it was below ground level, and so with all the rain that one usually gets, those things were always wet, and they were just miserable. That was one type. Another type was to have a sturdy brick shelter with a concrete roof in the streets. Put that in the center of this, down the center of the street. There weren't many cars during the war, and so everyone would go out at the sound of the siren, and you would go to a certain place and lie down. And the children, we had on our siren suits, which were essentially like track pants and tracksuit. But quickly get into it and zip up, and then carried out and put down to sleep. And my brother was there, and he was next in line with another young fellow, and the fellow had impetigo on his feet, and then his feet were touching my brother's head. And my brother got impetigo, and oh, it was terrible. He had to have his whole head shaved and treated and so on. So that meant that he could not be evacuated. He was ill. So we'll come back to that, perhaps, if I remember. So that was the long street shelter. You could have a similar type in your back garden. At least it was above ground. It was dry. And a concrete roof and a blast wall in front of the door. And there was part of one side which was very lightly mortared in. And you could easily break that should there be a direct hit and get out. The sand would flow from the rocks. So that was that type. Then the fourth type I remember was the one that you'd have here in a room. And it was rectangular. It was about this height. Stainless steel, about a half inch stainless steel roof and supports. And then a mesh around each side. And for quite considerable time, my brother and I slept in one of those. It was bigger than this table. It was perhaps out to there. And you could use it to play on, put ships on, or whatever.
So these were, sounds like some of them, people would buy them for their families. Is that, or were they provided by the government?
I think they were all provided. I don't know anything about the financial arrangements for them, no.
So they wanted to at least provide as much protection for the civilian population yes. as possible.
Yes.
And so this part of the country, was it as, I know London, I think, got quite a bit of attention.
Yes.
The Newcastle upon Tyne area, was that also a place where was, the Deutsch Germans thought would be worth attacking? Or?
Yes, because we you have London here on the south coast and up, and the Wash and then up. And this is the Scottish border, and here is Newcastle. So there's a river there. The main railway, of course, goes up through Newcastle, north-south railway, and then distributed. Here was a coal mining and shipbuilding and ship repair and goods. So this area had a lot of activity, and that controlled, it was the main route to Scotland. There was another one here, but not quite as, and so that was attacked a number of times.
So, in your actual school day, you the school administration had to be concerned about moving people to a safe place, or was there much bombing activity during the day?
Very little.
Very little during the day.
Yes,
so
yes.
It was always at night.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
That was fun.
We had practices and there were shelters, but there was I don't recall ever being exposed to a day raid. There were other in other places, but not in Newcastle. No.
Okay. So, in your education at this point, when somewhere along the way maybe you started to develop an interest in science, I guess, did it start in grade school or in lower grades? Or?
No, I don't remember having any, not until, Morse code was the biggest interest I had up until I was 11. The war ended when I was 11, so I then went, there was 11 plus exam. The end of sort of junior school, elementary school, that was a great divide. There was the washed and the unwashed. The washed went to grammar schools, the unwashed went to other schools. I went to a grammar school, my brother went to the other school. So I was in the first post-war class at Whitley Bay Grammar School. Whitley Bay, Whitley, and that's about 12 miles northeast of Newcastle, and we were right on the coast. So that class still has an annual reunion.
Oh my.
We came to school certificate in 1950, that was 5 years, and that... there's still the reunion, and I went last year when I was 79. So they met this year, and they've done so for about 30 years now.
Wow.
So that's it's quite a reunion.
I can imagine.
Yes, because you remember all the names. It's not Richard. It's Dickie.
Yeah.
his wife looks. it's a lot of fun, but that then was serious. Going to the grammar school, and that process was a selection, and a very important selection in England. I think it still is important, but it's more flexible now. You can crisscross later, but at that time, really, you couldn't get in at a later date.
You either made it or else.
Or else, exactly. And so we were very well taught. During the first 2 years, it was mainly women teachers and old men. But the physics teacher was just Bung, all sorts of names. Bung was just wonderful.
That was two N's?
No, B-U-N-G.
B-U-N-G.
I don't know how it arose, but it was... Oh, his name was Young. It's Mr. Young, so he was called Bung. Bung being a chemical rubber thing. And there was a Mr. Faucus, F-A-W-C-U-S... Harry Hardman, H-A-R-D-M-A-N. He was the chemistry teacher, and he was very instrumental in my later interests.
You know, just to back up a second, yes? You know what it was that you did on this test that got you into the washed crowd? The test was on, I guess, reading, writing, arithmetic, I
yes.
suppose.
Yes, about, it was about, I think, three exams,
mm-hmm.
Which you train for. I mean, we were a team. We were being trained for this. We were looking at all exam papers going through. We were up for it.
Okay. All right.
Basic arithmetic, grammar, sentence structure, reading, comprehension, and then some intelligence type questions,
mm-hmm.
which were great fun.
Yes, and important too. As well.
Very important. Yeah. Yes, yeah. Yeah. More than we knew.
Very good. Okay, so then you were saying that Hardman.
Hardman. Yes, Harry Hardman.
Got you interested in chemistry.
Chemistry. Yes. Methods of determining molecular weights, densities. I mean, some beautiful physical chemistry done with some nice apparatus, and then close reasoning and so on. So, I was very impressed there. After I think a couple of years, we had some teachers coming back from the war. One had been an English professor had been. In a prisoner of war camp, and he had been the librarian. He was an English graduate, you see, so he was made the librarian, and he had a very nice dictionary, which had to be hollowed out to put the radio in.
Oh,
and, and then someone came back for mathematics, and he was really very good, and I enjoyed mathematics.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember that teacher?
No.
Yeah, maybe it'll come later.
No. Yes.
So when you say mathematics, this would be algebra, trigonometry.
Calculus. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So you basically start thinking about the
all
more
the way through.
Sophisticated
yes.
mathematical tools.
Yes. Yeah. When I enjoyed Latin, which I took for 2 years, and alas, I didn't. I didn't work enough at it. It's an endings language, and I didn't work enough at it. We were doing French also at the same time, history, geography, art.
It had a certain broad educational scope.
Yes, but I found Latin very useful. I mean, for example, desiccator. You know how many times I have had to correct the spelling of D-E-S-S-I-C-A-T? It is desicco, to take, to withdraw water, which is one S and two C's, not two S's and one C. And it comes straight from the Latin. And it's amazing how much you see that has a Latin root.
It is. Indeed.
So it was marvelous. So...
So this would be, you were, like, this is the equivalent of like high school, we call
yes.
it high school.
Grammar school, high school, yes.
Now was this, these classes, was the school all boys, or was it mixed boys and girls?
Mixed.
Mixed at that time?
Mixed, yes.
Okay,
yes.
Okay. So that was, and girls, though, their education, even though they were in this upper level of education, were they expected to go on to anything? Education-wise, you know, or is that just happened that they were promoted into this better school?
They were in this better school, and some of them became scientists, veterinarians, doctors, administrative hospital people, business. Some of them did very well, and I found that out as I went back.
Mm-hmm.
My wife was from the same school, and she ended up as a principal here in Peterborough, from kindergarten to principal. So there was no difference. The only differentiation was that the girls had to take domestic science.
Oh, yes, domestic science.
And the boys had to take workshop.
Uh-huh.
Now, The only thing was there was no equipment in the workshop. There was absolutely nothing. Never even got to hold a chisel. We were told, in theory, how to sharpen a chisel, and we had to do drawings, fine drawings of friezes, for example.
Oh, wow.
Frieze, something like this. You'd have to draw. That was to polish your drawing skills and appreciation of shape and form. But there was no workshop. I felt cheated at that because now, owning a house for about 50 odd years, you really need some skills.
Yes.
And there's an organization called Habitat for Humanity, uh-huh. and they have asked me to take part in this, say, a number of times here in Peterborough. And I've said, I wouldn't dare. I hardly know how to handle a hammer. And you don't want me anywhere near a house here. I remember going to buy an outer door for the back here, a sun door. Keep the insects out. A screen is what I'm thinking of. And I went to Home Hardware, and the man was saying, are you going to install it? And my wife, I didn't know, was just behind me. She was saying, and it wasn't. I have just no skills.
Yeah. And all because you didn't have any tools under the shop.
Yes, I mean, it was a critical age, 11, 12. I'd have taken to it like a... like a fish to water,
had we
had the stuff. But this was the end of the war. Sure. It was gone, yes.
How big were the classes?
The classes were almost 50.
Yeah, okay.
There were four, 1A, 2A, 3A, and 4A, and each contained about 50 people. We had about 100 people admitted each year to the local grammar school. But that had been the same size in the year before with a Miss Beatty, and we had done very well as a class in the scholarship 11 plus exams. We had entered a choir competition and we had won in Newcastle, and then we gave a dancing exhibition. There was a Miss Jakes who was trying to teach us dancing and pointing our toes down to the floor. All very useful later.
Right.
Yes, and so we had done that with in our last year in the elementary school. So that had been quite nice. When I got into grammar school, I was still in the Scouts.
Oh, okay.
And at that time,
that's Boy Scouts. Right?
Boy Scouts, and at that time. There was a fellow called Ralph Reader, R-A-L-P-H and R-E-A-D-E-R, nothing odd about his name. He had been a producer of West End shows in London. He was a musical fellow, and he had been called into the RAF, and he organized concerts throughout the war for troops and military personnel and so on. And he came back. He was a very keen scouter and came back, and he wrote Gang Shows. A gang show is a musical, a mixture of musical and numbers and skits and whole group, large choir, singing numbers, put on in a local theater. Seven performances. Monday to Friday, and two shows on Saturday. At the end of that, you were really exhausted because you had school as well and traveling up.
Was this something that you volunteered for?
Yes.
Or were volunteered for?
No. Volunteered. You tried out.
Mm-hmm.
But because I had this dancing thing, you see, with Miss Jakes, I was put into the tap dancing class. So in the evening, stepping out. it all helps. So the first one was in 1947. It said something like there was a song, and after 14 long, no, that was another one. 1947, and the gang show is back in town.
Uh-huh.
So it had been there before the war. But that was a great recovery. Now, so I was.
He organized these things as part of the scouting activity.
Yes.
This was really something that he had developed for the Boy Scouts.
Yes. In London, Glasgow, major towns. We had our local producers, Ted Potts and his sister Nellie Potts. Nellie was the dancing instructress, and you would always go in uniform. Always in uniform. The practices were in uniform, unless until you got to the dress rehearsals and things. The main opening number, the end of the first act, the end of the second act, the finale, always in uniform. Mm-hmm. The only change would be a common necktie. Mm-hmm.
So, did you do any like more traditional scouting activities like campouts and that kind of thing?
Oh yes, okay. yes. Became a King Scout. Mm-hmm. King George died in 1951, so I was in just before he died, went to Windsor Castle, mm-hmm. and was given the King Scout badge by the Chief Scout at that time.
And what size were your troops, your Scout troops? Did you have
size, the number of people in the 12th Whitley Bay troop, there would be about 24. Mm,
okay.
Yes.
And was the participation pretty good in these things? I mean, you know, sometimes scout troops are kind of like so-so, but others are more gung-ho. Was participation pretty good?
Well, this was after the war. We couldn't go during the war. There were wolf cub packs during the war because they met late in the afternoon.
Yeah.
But there were virtually no scouts. It was just too dangerous at night.
Uh-huh.
So this was a new thing that we could do, and there were a number of scout troops. Almost every church mm-hmm. in our area, Whitley Bay, had a scout troop.
Whitley Bay.
Whitley Bay.
Okay. I'm just kind of curious because my son's went through Scouts and this is an interesting experience for them. But I'm being in a dance troupe and whatnot. I don't know.
Dancing. You know, it's a discipline.
Oh,
it's a lot of exercise. Mm-hmm. We were taught by dancing instructresses, instructors as you call them today. And there was no messing about. The discipline was firm during these rehearsals. Uh-huh. We would take the local Theatre Royal, you know, with four levels of audience for a full week. It was a major expense, and so you can't mess around.
Yeah. And then these shows, were they given gratis, or did you charge for the show?
Oh no, yes. Seats, every seat was charged. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you did this for a number of years with
about 6 years. Yes, oh, wow. Some years with my brother. Mm-hmm. And 51. Then after that, I took ill. Mm. That sort of changed things. Mm. So it was 45, and then 51. Then 51. Sometime late in 51, I got what they thought was poliomyelitis.
Oh,
there was a lot of it going around.
Oh, yeah.
Paralysis of the legs and so on. So I was laid up. I'm just trying to think.
Yeah, that was bad. I remember even, you know, myself and my youth that was a big problem. You know, so much concern about polio.
Yes. Yes.
But so they thought you might have had it, but obviously that wasn't it.
No. It recovered. There was a loss of feeling in the legs, one more than the other. But then eventually it recovered, and I managed to get out of bed and walk, and then life went on. But I had lost some schooling, and the schooling was in what we call the lower sixth. I had done 5 years in grammar school, mm-hmm. then you do two more years, lower sixth and upper sixth. when you go from doing a school certificate examinations to higher school certificate examinations. These names have all changed.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a difference. And of course, higher school was required to get into university.
Mm-hmm.
So I had missed that time. So as my health was unsure, I didn't want to just wait and do nothing and go back in. Mm-hmm. To the next year, and so I applied for a position as an industrial chemist, apprentice industrial chemist, at Wall's End on Tyne. And Wall's End is where this musical in New York is being shown. WALLSEND, Wall's End dash on dash TYNE. Tyne, that's the river Tyne.
Uh-huh. So you were, how long were you not able to go to school? Was it like
about months? 2 months.
About 2 months,
yes.
Okay. And this is really kind of set you back.
Yes.
So the apprentice, that was like the only thing open to you at the time, or?
Well, this is the middle of the year. Life in Britain was fairly simple in those days, but highly structured.
Mm-hmm.
And if you drop out of 1 year, there's nothing else to do, really, except find a job, do something, deliver newspapers, whatever. So I saw this advertisement, and at least it was chemistry. It was in a chemistry laboratory, and I thought it would be interesting, and it was.
Mm-hmm. Yes. What was the name of this outfit that you printed?
Pamatrada. PAMETRADA.
Pamatrada
Research Station.
Okay.
And I'll let you write it out because the name is interesting. Parsons, PARSONS,
uh-huh.
And Marine Engineering Turbine Research and Development Association.
Okay.
Parsons, of course, were very active in making optical instruments.
Okay.
And simple gas analysis systems.
Mm-hmm.
Turbine research was gas turbines.
Ah, okay.
Coming from aircraft and Frank Whittle's work with aircraft and looking to put these in destroyers. If you put them in destroyers and send them off, the problem is that they like to run on kerosene. And the supply of kerosene around the world is very uncertain.
Mm-hmm.
What is certain is the supply of crude oil.
Mm-hmm.
And so these turbines had to be able to run on crude oil. Well, there's a lot of sodium and vanadium in what we call the ash of crude oil. So when it's burned and the, what's the nurses call it? Not incinerator, in the flame. The fuel is heated and then it's atomized, very much like electrospray. So you get tiny droplets, gouttelets in French, in a hot air and they evaporate fairly quickly. So they, of course, give out a lot of energy in the combustion, and the ash is mainly of sodium vanadates, which at the temperature of the turbine can be quite corrosive. And so they would land on the blades and stick and corrode the turbine blades.
Mm-hmm.
So what had to be done was to try to find some additive to put into, be able to put into crude oil and prevent this ashing problem.
Hmm.
So it was very interesting. Vanadium comes from a very small amount of vanadium in organic plants. But of course the oil has come from plants and so the vanadium is still there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what part did you play? You were just part of the hands-on?
Oh, I cleaned the lab, I cleaned the bottles, I cleaned the sink, I did this, I did that, I did everything. I made coffee in the morning for the three. We had a metallurgist and two chemists, and then our boss, who was a physicist would come in, and another, it would be something like five would come in, and I would make coffee in beakers for them. It was lovely coffee, and I knew just what each one wanted, and the value was I got to listen to their conversation.
Oh, okay.
Because they were they weren't discussing the girls in the office, they were discussing the work. So this was, I did anything I could.
So you were learning all about this chemistry.
Yes, yes, yes. It was really something. And as I got to be 18, close to 18, you had to go into the national services.
Mm-hmm.
There was conscription.
Mm-hmm.
However, if you were in a registered apprenticeship program and going to classes, that could be delayed until you'd finished your program.
Okay, so what during this apprenticeship you actually were going to the school?
I had one day off a week. I had to be given one day off a week. So I went 4 days to work during the winter terms, 4 days to work, and 1 day to Rutherford College of Technology in Newcastle.
Okay. So you had kind of dropped out, but you hadn't dropped out.
Yes.
In a sense.
Yes.
And so that one day of week you went to, what were you studying? Were you like continuing with your program?
What they call the national certificates now, not the the school certificate, but the national certificate, which was for industrially based.
Okay.
And there were a series of examiners and examining board to set up these national and higher national certificate examinations.
Okay, so you were not completely unwashed, but not completely washed.
That's right, that's right. I had switched to the more technical part, but doing mathematics, physics, and chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
And then I took a couple of courses in the evening, so I did a day and then 2 evenings. And then eventually, as this went on, I managed to get an extra half day off and took another course. So I was doing 5 courses, as well as working 3.5 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
And so it came to the end of this was taking 18 exams.
Okay.
18 exams. I applied to 3 boards, university boards, you see. And they had 18, and they didn't overlap. They didn't... So I didn't have any.
The reason you had to take 18 was because you were applying to 3 different schools, or because
I was applying to university, and I didn't want to be caught on one exam by one school board, there was variation, and of course they changed each year the exams.
Mm-hmm.
But by this time, I knew there's nothing goes on steadily forever.
Mm-hmm.
There are discontinuities. And so if you look at back exams and say that's going to happen to the next 20 years, it's not so. So you have to be wary that things are going to undergo a disruptive change.
Mm-hmm.
And so I applied for these 18. Plus experimental laboratory exams. Anyway, I got through. I got the whole lot.
So these you had selected 3 different schools.
Yes.
They were?
No. Boards. And then universities. I applied to Durham University, which was the name of the university in Newcastle.
Mm-hmm.
King's College in Durham at that time was in Newcastle. Now that is called the University of Newcastle University. The name has changed, but I applied there because that was local. I applied to Nottingham University, which was very nice. I also applied to Leeds University. Leeds I was very impressed with.
Mm-hmm.
Went down for a visit, and there was a huge building at the front, and went in there, and there was a parquet floor. I covered the whole, it was a very Romanesque building, and then passed through. And on the side of the wall was this, I've forgotten the word, this plaque for Father and Son Bragg Team.
No.
Near this site was the laboratory of Father and Son Bragg Team. And then went into the library, the big circular library, which is very similar to our parliamentary library in Ottawa. And there was a picture in today's paper.
Mm.
of this circular library. The Brotherton Library was the name. And I really liked it. Mm-hmm. And can I jump? That was 1950, spring of 1954. Mm-hmm. Can I jump now to 1986?
Okay.
32 years later, my supervisor at U of T not only got himself onto a Canadian stamp.
Oh, wow.
But he won the Nobel Prize. He won the Nobel Prize first, and then got himself. Yeah. This was the year of chemistry.
Uh-huh.
And
so his name was?
John C. Polanyi.
Oh, yeah.
Polanyi.
Yes.
And if you go to the University of Toronto, you will find, just as you go in the building on College Street, a plaque which says, near this place is the laboratory of John C. Polanyi. It's a repeat of the one I saw in Leeds. And Chester Sadowski and I, who were his first students, arranged for the university to install that plaque on the wall.
Chester, how do you spell it?
Chester Sadowski, Sadowski.
Okay. So, excuse me, you decided to attend Leeds?
Yes.
Okay.
So, 1954, I entered the Honours Chemistry Program at Leeds University.
Ah, okay. And that was because of your ability to pass all these exams that you were able to take that as an option.
And make very good coffee for my bosses. I didn't have to continue doing that once I got to the university. The university was a wonderful place. There was Professor Cox and Professor Dainton, to become Lord Dainton, and some very other famous people.
Would you look yourself up there?
It was...
Professor Cox?
Professor Cox.
C-O-X.
Inorganic crystallography, mm-hmm. and Professor Dainton, physical chemistry, D-A-I-N-T-O-N.
Okay.
Dainton, who was a leading light in the study of radioactivity and its use for irradiating people.
Mm. So this would be like for curing diseases?
Yes, curing, okay. Particularly cancer.
Okay.
Yes. Mm. Yes.
And he was doing this work at Leeds.
No, yes.
And he was one of your instructors.
Yes.
Uh huh. Okay. And what science? What part of the chemistry was he instructing about radioactivity?
He was physical chemistry.
Physical chemistry. Yes.
Chain reactions, gas phase chain reactions, and energy transfer, and irradiation. When you irradiate someone, you know, with a beam. It's not like Beer's Law. It doesn't just go as a beam straight through and just moderately attenuated. It is rapidly attenuated, so the particles slow down,
mm-hmm.
and then they're almost arrested. And if you do it correctly, you can have them being arrested at the site of the cancer cells.
Okay.
And then they continue to radiate. And it's almost as good as injecting something directly into the cell. Yes.
Interesting.
Yes.
So he was developing the science at the time.
Yes.
Wow. Okay. Now, is this during your undergraduate?
Or this is undergraduate.
Undergraduate.
Yes.
So, and you had, by this time, you were liberated from working as an apprentice.
Yes.
And obviously, they paid you. I assume, did they, for the apprentice work?
For the apprenticeship?
Yeah.
I was paid for the apprenticeship and went to university with the permission mm-hmm. of Pamatrada and blessing of, mm-hmm. of Pamatrada, a company, as the first apprentice to do so.
Hmm.
But having gone with their permission and blessing at vacations, particularly the summer vacations, I could go back and work as long as, until I had completed the 5 years. And I did that, and at the end of 5 years, I got a certificate saying you've completed the apprenticeship.
So the apprenticeship program was formalized to the point that you, there was a fixed amount of time in which you were an apprentice, and then you essentially graduated to the apprenticeship.
I was indentured to that company for 5 years, yes. Yes.
Interesting. And what did that certificate provide you the rights and privileges of?
Oh, being an industrial chemist. Yes.
So that was basically you could apply for a job as an industrial chemist anywhere in the UK.
Yes, at the lab bench.
Yes.
Yes.
So it was a learning experience as well as being, I mean, as an apprentice, you were actually learning some.
Oh, learned a great deal, mm-hmm. and it was really a very modern type of institute. I told you last night about the NATO conferences, mm-hmm. how the waiters would line up and take you into a table and then the next table. Well, that's one way of doing it. The other way, of course, is to fix the tables, mm-hmm. and you have a seat at a table. This company had a dining room. Mm-hmm. And it had two lunches, one at 12 and one at 1. And there was a table for 8 people. 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. That was my seat. Mm-hmm. At my seat were two physicists, mm-hmm. one other apprentice, someone from the financial office, and an engineer. Mm-hmm. Marvelous discussions, mm-hmm. of course. Every day we met for lunch, mm-hmm. and there was an Austrian, Kantorovich, Dr. Kantorovich. We were very rude.
How do you spell that?
I don't remember. I've just remembered the rude name we used to call him. Kantorovich, K-A-N-T. O-R-O-W-I-C-Z, I think.
Oh, okay.
Kantorovich. And there was always some cookies or little pastries left for dessert, and he would grab the plate and say, "Which boy is the most deserving?" Moving it around the table so quickly he couldn't take one, and then he would take it himself.
Okay. What science did he bring to the table?
Physics. Yes, yeah. And they would talk about the problems of these jet, mm-hmm. Turbines, the velocity, wind effects, the flame, optimizing flame characteristics, mm-hmm. transfer of energy, viscosity. Just so many, and because we were the same people each day, people just talked. I mean, they didn't say, "Oh, he's an apprentice. I won't talk to him." They just addressed the table. It was interesting that similar thing happened when I went to France in 1972. I joined a group at Orsay, and they didn't have a table, but they all went to eat from the laboratory at the same time for lunch. Perhaps 8-10 people around a table. Now, it was hell, because the English would speak one at a time and have a discussion. The French, 3 or 4 would speak at one time. Yeah. And so trying to follow 3 or 4 conversations in a foreign language is virtually impossible, and it just blows your mind. Your ears are wide open. And it was really a difficult time. I enjoyed the fellowship, but the language was...
So, where did you pick up French, the ability to...
Oh, in school.
That was in your...
In the grammar school.
Grammar school.
Yes, yes.
So that was taught as well as Latin?
Yes.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yes.
So, did you, I guess, become sufficiently proficient in French that you could manage?
A little bit, yes, yes. And at one time I had gone to a jamboree in France. I had got two, I don't think I mentioned that.
As a Boy Scout,
in 1950 I went to Germany. Mm-hmm. I went to Düsseldorf, a town called Neviges, N-E-V-I-G-E-S, Neviges, and to meet a German troop. This was an organization called Die Brücke, the bridge, an attempt by some enlightened citizens to try to bring English and German young fellows together so that learn that there's more than just war ahead.
Yeah.
It was very, very good. We went to Bonn, saw the Parliament building in Bonn, went to the Krupp, went to the works of Krupp at Essen,
mm-hmm.
and went to Cologne. Now, these were all of interest later. At the Krupp's work in Essen, there was a paternoster. He went in the door, there was a reception desk at the right, and then just continued around, and there was a paternoster. A paternoster is an elevator that goes like this and has no doors.
Hmm.
First time I'd ever seen one. Damn dangerous, I thought.
Oh, yeah.
But it stuck in my mind. Gosh.
Uh-huh.
And it just kept going. You go up, get off. The same thing happens with the eye in London.
Hmm.
The big eye in London doesn't stop. It goes sufficiently slowly, you just walk on the platform and step on and off. It's the same principle.
But the big eye.
The big eye.
Is that EYE?
EYE, yes.
That's a conveyance of some kind.
That's right, yes. Put up by a tremendous difficulty, and they were helped by a German company that brought over a platform and helped to assemble it. They put it up like a wheel of a car, of a bicycle. They put it up like this,
mm-hmm.
and they had problems. Anyway, so that was Krupp's. The rest of the factory was just a mass of tangled, rusted steel.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you went to Germany in 1950, it was probably still pretty much bad shape.
It was. Düsseldorf was, there were beginnings of reconstruction in Düsseldorf. In Cologne, all the rubble had simply been taken from the road and put into the interior of the buildings, and they were just stark.
Mm-hmm.
The cathedral was still standing, some minor damage, and there was a new bridge across the Rhine.
Yeah.
There
was an attempt to get the German and English scouts to communicate on a peaceful level.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it must have been a terrible event for everyone.
Yes, it was.
At that time.
Yes.
Because I saw recently, there's actually, I think you can see on the internet, this filmmaker, Hitler's filmmaker, had created this documentary, and a lot of it shows the German youth being indoctrinated.
Oh, yes. Yes, they were.
With the Nazi, worldview towards... it's very interesting documentary. I shouldn't recall the person's name, but it really is probably the most powerful propaganda film that was ever made, because it was shown to the German people and really convinced them that this was the way to go. And pretty scary.
Mm-hmm. Hitler, I think, picked up on Baden-Powell's idea and took it to extremes.
Mm-hmm. Now, so Scouts actually started in the UK, right, with Baden-Powell?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
About 1907, I think, Brown Sea Island.
Okay, yes. So it would be, it's not unusual that she would be involved in Boy Scouting. I mean, that would be kind of a typical thing. Or is it pretty much a common thing for most kids?
Yes, many kids, yes. And we'd have church parade once a month. Mm-hmm. And go to the local, it was a church troop, so you would go to the church. And I've been an Anglican ever since.
Uh-huh, okay. Interesting. Okay, so we were talking about...
Krupps. Yes.
Krupps.
Yes. Krupps. There's a wonderful book called The Armors of Krupp.
Uh-huh.
And I read it in France one time. And it took me back to something that I had been associated with. I'm sorry. There are streams... Like streams of warmer water in a river,
mm-hmm.
Which is continuous, but it's not the same as the water beside it. There are stories that go through. Krupps. I was at McGill. I had finished. This is 1962, and I was at McGill University, 1962-63. And there was a fellow called Jerry Bull, GerryBull.
One L?
One LL. Bull. He was the youngest PhD at University of Toronto, mm-hmm. something at 19. Mm-hmm. He had built... He wanted to build a, what we call a, I've forgotten the name, a cylinder through which he would pass air at high speed.
A wind tunnel.
And so he built the wind tunnel. The tunnel as he built it happened to go through a corner of the dean's office, but that was all right. He'd come in at the weekend. And took it through, and he became a professor at McGill University. So he's a graduate of University of Toronto, professor at McGill when I was there. And he had a contract to investigate micrometeorite impacts.
Okay.
Even in 1962, there was not a great deal of knowledge of what... What was up there, yes. If you put something up, a stationary satellite, which of course is not stationary, it's whizzing around at the same point, same time as the Earth, to what impacts would it be subjected? What is there? What's their velocities, etc.? So he built this hydrogen gun, long cylinder, and with hydrogen you can get high speeds, and he would fire plastic bullets. About that size, Mike.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps a little, slightly bigger diameter, but about that size.
Mm-hmm.
Polyethylene.
Mm-hmm.
And they would go about 33,000 feet per second.
Oh, wow.
And they would smash into a block of aluminum, or zinc, or iron, or steel, about that size, mounted in an evacuated sphere.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a spectrograph focused on the point of impact.
Okay.
And you know, this block of metal would almost entirely vaporize.
Oh, really?
Oh, tremendous energy. Even from the small mass, 33,000 feet per second. It's the velocity squared. The mass is linear. The velocity is squared. Very, very interesting stuff. He went from there to... He went from there to proposing a gunshot to launch satellites from guns,
mm-hmm.
Naval guns. World War I naval guns in particular, and he managed to get two from the U.S. government.
Hmm.
And they landed them for him in Barbados about 1960. And they were transported, they made a small railway, and they were transported to the second beach near the airport in Barbados. There is one beach, and then there's a cliff, and there's another beach, and then another cliff. And this is on the middle one. And I've been there, I've seen it. It's 119 feet long and mounted almost vertically. And they would load in a payload, and they would ram in the fuel for the gun and then fire it off.
Straight up.
About 87 degrees or something to it. So fairly horizontal. And then they had two islands with lighthouses that could triangulate on the signal. Now, he fired stuff up to 137 kilometers. He was doing great guns. Mm. And it's a wonderful story. It's called the HARP, H-A-R-P, the McGill's High Altitude Research Program. Mm. He was doing very well.
And what was the purpose of this vertical shot?
To explore the atmosphere.
So he was going to upper atmosphere levels.
Upper atmosphere levels, yes, and to investigate the possibility of launching satellites into orbit from a gun, not from a rocket. The other people, that's mainly in the States, were, of course, building rockets and rocket sites to launch satellites, and that came directly from the German rockets, which were seized and transported to the States. Okay. So he was in competition with that.
Uh-huh. So, but apparently it didn't fly. In the end, it didn't win.
He didn't. He didn't get any money. Mm-hmm. He met with a high government official called C.M. Drury in Ottawa. I think Drury was the head of the Treasury for one of our governments. And he was to listen to this presentation. So Bull gave the presentation, what he wanted to do, why he wanted to do it, benefits, the cost, etc. And then Drury made the big mistake of asking something, and Bull put down his chalk and said, "You don't know a damn thing about science." That was the end of that.
Oh, yeah.
Didn't get another cent.
No.
Now, the interesting thing is that there is a border, the border between Canada here to the north and the USA to the south. There's one in New York State, and it's horizontal. I mean, it's east-west, and Bull had access to, I think this is called high water. It was about 100 acres, and he developed a gun. His own gun. He had done lots of experiments in Barbados on the two, particularly with the size of the grain in the propellant and the rate of firing or combustion of the propellant and the acceleration of the body as it went up, and then the effect of having a longer barrel. And he bet at some stage he could fire a gun from Canada to Mexico without touching the U.S. So now there was a dean Mordell at McGill. He was the dean of engineering. He was M-O-R-D-E-L-L. Donald Mordell.
And?
And by strange coincidence, Mike, this is amazing. He owned a property adjacent to the border, and directly opposite Bull's property. So this was Modell, and this was Bull. So they could have people come and visit Modell and spend a weekend in his cottage and do a shooting center, whip across here to Canada, see Bull's demonstrations of his gun, and go back again, and nobody knew they'd been in Canada. There's no record. So he got money from the States. He was granted honorary citizenship by Barry Goldwater. Oh, I have a record of this. Because he needed to get access to Hanscom Field, something like that. I have the details written down. I was going to write a book about it. My wife protested. So I have a lot of details. But he was encouraged to do this, and he was supported. And he developed his gun, and there was a strange story of off the coast of South Africa. There was 20, 30 miles off the coast of South Africa, Cape Town, there was an explosion one night.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we have satellites.
Mm-hmm.
Satellites pick up signals. This had the signature of a nuclear explosion.
Mm.
And it is thought that Bull had fired, taken one of his guns, and had fired a nuclear device with the help of the Israelis.
What?
And it exploded here. It hit a target ship. But that was it. I'm cutting the story a little short. Anyway, Bull went on to develop this gun, and he developed the super gun.
Mm-hmm.
And he then sold the super gun to Saddam Hussein, mm-hmm. which started the Gulf War. But before that, he'd been involved in Africa in a number of minor wars, and he had the I think it was the G50 gun.
Hmm.
And this was a gun of a really extraordinary length in the barrel.
Fascinated by guns, was he?
Yeah, he's fascinated. Oh, yes, the big Bertha of the First World War, absolutely fascinated with that.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote many things. So this gun in Africa would fire shells. Now, it's not as though they were huge, but the shell was fired with such velocity that if it hit... So we have something here, so we fire the gun, and here's the top of the hill. When the shell hit the top of the hill would disappear.
Mm.
There was so much energy being dissipated. So this played a major role in the various battles in Africa in the around about 1960, late 50s, 1960. Mm. So he developed the gun, which had enormous terminal velocity in coming out of it, and he made it much bigger, 1 meter, and he was shipping this to Saddam Hussein when it was spotted in England, at Middlesbrough.
Mm.
I actually went to visit the customs officer at Middlesbrough who had spotted this, and I was told, he's no longer working here.
Mm.
He has been shifted to another, do you know where? No. Nothing. It was a big to-do.
So when you were, well, we kind of leapfrogged a
yes.
bit here, but I just want to get one point. You were working at the time when he was at McGill.
Yes.
Looking at the, focusing a spectroscopic tool at the back of this plate that was going to be
yes, hit. Yes.
And what was what you were going to find out, the energy that was dissipated?
Was the energies of the lines of the lines produced
mm-hmm.
that were detected by the spectrograph.
Okay.
Yes.
And this was essentially, this was a scientific effort to understand the result of a high velocity impact of a particle on different types of materials.
Yes.
And but basically, you're saying the just vaporized the material.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
Just because you had the velocity, you had the velocity up that such a high speed.
Yes.
Wow.
So he had this, was building and constructed part of this super gun in Iraq, mm-hmm. and he was assassinated.
We can guess by who, I guess.
Yes, yes, he was assassinated in Brussels.
When did that happen?
I think that was 1990.
And that pretty much put the kibosh on the gun, on the big gun.
On the big gun, but you recall that Schwarzkopf, mm-hmm. who was in charge of the Gulf War, the troops landed, I think it was August 1990.
Yeah, I don't remember.
I think it was August 1990. The troops landed, the NATO troops, and they were held back until January. Not a soul moved mm-hmm. in January. The only people who went to war were the aircraft, mm-hmm. and they went on bombing. And because Saddam had something like 600 of Jerry Bull's guns, mm-hmm. and each of them with a little computer and a truck, so they were mobile, and each of them outdistanced the tanks available to Schwarzkopf. They could fire 30, 40 miles. So he waited until the aircraft had destroyed, brought this down to about 60 or so. And we had thousands, hundreds of thousands of people sitting on the ground for 4 months.
Enormous cost. There was this kind of long period where we were waiting.
Yes.
Everybody was antsy because they were wondering what's going to happen. Are we going to do it or not?
If only Canada had given him $500,000 a year to continue his research, none of that would have happened.
Interesting.
Oh, yes, yes. We have people giving money out in Canada. They have no idea why they're doing it.
Well, yeah, that's another story.
Yes.
Okay, we got to get to kind of back up a little bit because I think we got a little bit off the path. But you've got your apprentice. I guess it's not a degree; it's a certificate.
Yes.
And you're going now. You've gotten into the school that you want to go to, and are you still an undergraduate at this point?
Yes.
Okay.
1954, undergraduate. Went to these two things. I went into residence, which was very nice. Devonshire Hall, and this was to have some after effects when I came to apply to Trent years later.
Okay,
but Devonshire Hall, and it was really very nice arrangement. And I still had to do conscription. And I didn't fancy going into the army and carrying a heavy rifle, so I managed to get into the air squadron. Mm-hmm. So I became a pilot on Chipmunks, which was a de Havilland Chipmunk, which were made in Canada at that time. And they were fully aerobatic, and they were the aircraft assigned to all of the university air squadrons.
Okay.
So remember, Britain, this was, there was still the Cold War going on. This is 1954.
Yeah.
We needed pilots. We had this survival project with Berlin, when Berlin was encircled by the Russians and had to be supplied. That was done by aircraft. Even though it was very difficult to land and so on. But there was Berlin was kept alive.
Yes.
through pilots, and there was a big demand for pilots. So that's what I did. So the chemistry was marvelous at Leeds. The residence was great. I learned to fly, which was enormous fun. I played a little rugby for Devonshire Hall, and I boxed a couple of times for the university.
Oh, wow. Busy buddy.
Yes.
So this pilot, you learned to actually fly this chipmunk?
Yes.
Was this a prop plane? Or?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
And was it like 1, 2, 3, 4 engines?
One. Single engine. There's a Harvard just behind you. That was more powerful. The top left there. That was more powerful. We had a few hours in that, but most of our training was in chipmunks. But it's very much the wings down and the rather like a Spitfire or a Hurricane.
Mm-hmm.
But it had a fixed undercarriage.
Okay.
Yes.
So the wheels down all the time.
Yes, but you could go up to 8,000 feet. And then put it down and do a falling leaf and barrel rolls and stall turns. It was absolutely, and that was what we had to do. We had to practice and land it safely, of course, at the end of the day.
So, but you never really saw any military action?
It
was just you were prepared to be able to fly.
Yes.
I guess if you could fly that, then you could also be capable of flying several other airplanes of a similar vintage or type. So that conscription period was, now this is you volunteered to go to the Air Corps because you didn't want to lug a rifle around.
Yes.
This was for a specific period of time. I mean, when you signed up, you...
Both. 2 years.
2 years.
2 years, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So that was a full-time or part-time?
Full-time.
Full-time.
The conscription was full-time,
so
yes.
So you were basically, that was totally what you were doing for those 2 years.
Well, it would have been.
Would have been.
I'm still in my three-year undergraduate.
Okay.
54 to 57. Uh-huh. Training, doing pilot training so on. Ready at 57 to go into the Air Force and fly for 2 years.
Okay.
If you fly, you see, when you go in, you have a batman.
Yeah.
You have a batman.
Batman.
A batman, yes. And a batman in the Air Force is somebody who polishes your buttons and your shoes and brings you tea in the morning and tells you the weather forecast.
How do you spell that?
B-A-T-M-A-N, a batman.
Batman.
It's essentially a military servant.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Oh, that's cool.
Oh, yes, 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 yes.
So during these 2 years when you were totally devoted to your military...
Which I never was, but that would have happened.
Would have happened.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So what happened in lieu of those 2 years?
So, as I was coming to the end of my degree program, 1957...
This is undergraduate.
As undergraduate, there was a visit to Leeds from John Polanyi. He was a graduate of Manchester, and he had just obtained a job at University of Toronto the previous year.
Uh-huh.
So he was looking for graduate students. He had been to Manchester, and now he was at Leeds. Of course, he was a physical chemist. He knew Professor Dainton.
Uh-huh.
And so he was just seeing if there were any bodies around.
So he was just kind of starting his academic career.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And I was chair of the undergraduate chemical society. We had an undergraduate chemical society. We had rooms and a small library and a study place near the university. And I was elected president in my last year. It's very, very little work. But anyway, as such... I had to go and have lunch with Polanyi and Dainton. And then I promised I would pass on all the information. I'd make an announcement to everybody and pass it on. Any questions I would funnel appropriately. Then I learned, after the lunch, I learned that people going into the Air Force for national service and wishing to fly had to sign on for 3 years.
Mm.
All of a sudden... The supply of pilots was really more than their needs. And so they were insisting you sign on for a longer term. And so I asked, went to see the CEO and asked if, I don't mind doing that, but if I'm cut from flying, can one revert to the previous 2 years?
Yeah.
And he asked, no. Once you sign on for 3 years, you've signed on for 3 years.
Yeah.
Whatever you do is up to the government's choice and not yours.
Yeah, yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
So, now that was very different. Going in for 3 years, that was a longer time away from academia. I wanted to do a PhD. It meant a longer break. So I wrote to Polanyi. And he sent me the university sent me the application forms and applied for a scholarship and so on. And I was accepted. August the 12th of 1957, I landed in Canada.
Well, Polanyi was in the UK, right?
No, he was at University of Toronto.
Oh, he was at Toronto.
He'd started there in 1956.
I was confused there, but... Okay. So, you were able to, by getting into this postgraduate program, you were able to not have to satisfy any further obligation with the Air Force?
No, dodge. I was a draft dodger.
You left the country.
I left the country.
Uh-huh.
I left the country. I had trained for 3 years and the government changed the conditions.
Yeah.
So I didn't feel at all embarrassed to say, no, I'm a draft dodger because they changed the rules.
Uh-huh.
When I was in, there was no grandfathering. You see, they had changed the rules abruptly. And so I said, I'm going.
Okay.
So I went.
So at this time, did your parents have anything to say about this, or feel any feeling one way or the other, or were they still around?
Well, my mother, of course, yes. They were both. My parents had divorced, so my mother was living with my stepfather, and they were all disappointed, but supportive.
Uh-huh.
But supportive. Now, the other fly in the ointment was that by this time, my sort of steady girlfriend was Kathleen.
Uh-huh.
And her parents didn't like this
at all.
Uh-huh. Not at all. Anyway, she came with my mother and stepfather in a car to see me off at Prestwick, an airport near Glasgow.
Mm.
And I set off. I set off in a four-engine prop plane, which took 24 hours to get to Toronto.
Mm.
24 hours of flying time.
Mm.
We had 3 8-hour stints to Reykjavik, to Gander, and Toronto.
Mm.
And there's noisy, terribly noisy aircraft.
What was that second stop? I'm familiar with Reykjavik, but...
Reykjavik and then Gander in Newfoundland.
Oh, okay.
Gander has always been used by the Russians and the Cubans.
Mm-hmm.
Canada has always allowed them to land there.
Okay.
Because Canada has been sort of supportive. We don't have the same attitude to Cuba as does the U.S.
Yeah, well, the U.S.'s attitude is something else, but I won't go there. At any rate.
No. It means that we have the best of both worlds, the U.S. and Canada. Each can take their own stance, and business goes on as usual. Yes, there we are.
So it took you 24 hours of flying time to get here.
Yes.
That's got to be pretty rough.
Yes, and I was met at the airport by 2 graduate students, Ian Chapman and... Jim McCowan, Ian Chapman, Chapman,
and the other one,
and James McCowan, McCowan. Chapman was interested. He was the niece of Sidney Chapman, a well-known mathematician.
Huh.
But they met me. They'd been sent to meet me by Mrs. T. The secretary of the Department of Chemistry.
Mrs. T.
Mrs. T, yes.
Hmm. It's like T-E-A or T?
Just T. It was short for Thomason.
Okay.
It's like M, you know, in the James Bond thing.
Oh, okay.
Yes. And so they met me and took me to Toronto, the town and the university, and settled me in a room I've forgotten the name of the college, University College. Uh-huh. I thought I was going to die with the heat.
Oh, really?
It was August the 12th. Uh-huh. And I thought, I'm going to die, and my mother doesn't know where I am.
Well, I mean, Toronto doesn't get that hot in the summer, does it?
Yeah, it can get up to 40.
Well, yeah. Is that in Fahrenheit?
Fahrenheit? Well, it was 32.
100 degrees?
Yes, about 100. Just over, yes. Yeah. I've been hotter later, but yeah. It was hot, yes. Yeah. And of course, I had thick clothing on. Yeah. Anyway, the next day, I remember that well. My mother, I'm going to die, and my mother doesn't know where I am. And with that thought, I went to sleep. And the next day, I woke up, and we went for lunch, sitting under the trees on the campus, and I realized I would probably never go back to England to live.
Yes.
Right then.
Yeah.
Like a revelation.
Yeah.
Like making up my mind to move to Canada. I didn't apply other places. Yeah. I just made that decision. Although Polanyi was just a young lad at the time. He was only 5 years older than me.
Yeah.
And then this thing of knowing that I was... That's happened a number of times.
Hmm.
I've made a decision. Later on, in an elevator in McGill, I was expecting to meet Lord Dainton. Mm-hmm. Who was to give a lecture, and instead there was Polanyi. This was after I had finished my PhD. Mm-hmm. And with another fellow called Harold Schiff. Mm-hmm. Because of that, I went to work for Harold Schiff as a research associate. That's how I got to work with Gerald Bull and then Hugh McLennan. I got to know him, and he is an author. I've only applied for one job, I think. I've applied for two jobs in my life.
Mm-hmm.
One was the apprenticeship, the other was applied to Trent. Everything else has just happened. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So basically, Polanyi, you filled out the forms and you were agreed that you could come to Toronto and work
yes.
with Polanyi.
Yes.
And so now at this point in your life, you realize that this is a big step and your things have changed. You're
yes.
going to be a Canadian. Now, are you a Canadian?
Yes.
Okay, mm-hmm. So you're a Canadian citizen. What is the relationship between, you're a citizen of the UK?
Yes.
Do you have dual citizenship or is being
yes.
Canadian?
Yes, I have two passports.
You have two passports?
Yes.
Okay, so that must be fun.
It means you can visit a number of countries without bothering about visas.
Visas?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Most of the countries in Europe, and most of the countries in the Americas.
Mm-hmm. With your Canadian passport.
With one or the other.
One or the other.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's one convenient.
Oh yes, yes. It's very convenient.
Yeah. Yeah. Nice. And so after you get over your heat stroke, you have to get down to do your graduate work.
Yes.
Okay. This was 1954.
Yes.
And very good. Okay, well, you want to take a little bit of a break for a while?
Yes.
And then, we can stretch a little bit.
Yes.
It's a nice stopping off point. Let's see if I can stop this guy.